Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. I think that there are two aspects to the title. I think the first one is why bother, and then the other is it's all on the internet anyway. For Ajahn Sumedho, of course, the internet is a mystery. he does write emails by hand. which he then hands to somebody who types up. he doesn't. So if you get an email from him, it's been through it probably one or two people at least. he doesn't surf the web. He doesn't know how to use a mouse or a touchpad. The attitude of why bother, I think is reveals something about a sense of defeatism or a sense of a lack of self-respect actually. Understandable. Some of the time, understandable as a human experience, that sense of why bother, a sense of it doesn't matter what I do in the grand context of things, or I don't have any capacity to influence anything. Or do anything that's worthwhile, either to change my own circumstances or to affect any other circumstances. And what happens to your heart when that thought arises in your mind? Or that feeling arises in your mind. I know what happens in mine. it's depressing, and it's part. That's why I feel that for the way the Buddha's teaching. Runs this that would be counted in the realm of mundane wrong view. It's a view, a paradigm, a ditti in Pali, a way of looking at the world which is micha. It's sometimes translated as wrong. It's unskillful. It's not in attune with the Dhamma, with the truth, with that which leads to peace, because that sense of depression reinforces the sense of self. Actually, it's a depressed self, an isolated self, a self that doesn't like itself, Careful when that thought or that feeling arises, dependent upon conditions, dependent upon stimulations, past habits, encouragement from other people. However it arises, if that thought comes up, why bother? Careful. And there's a big flashing warning signs this is malware or a virus or something that will upset your machine. Don't believe it. If one considers what sammāditti or a perspective or a view or a paradigm or a way of approaching life, the sense of being here, that actually will lead to freedom from needing anything from the situation, or freedom from wanting to get rid of anything from the situation, or freedom from confusion, a paradigm or a place to stand or a place to come from, is that there is the possibility of awakening. Things are the result of causes, the causes that one creates through thought, through speech, and through action, bodily, they do matter, every single one. So that encouragement is ennobling. It allows one to feel that there can be a nobility in one's life. There is a possibility to awaken, to be, and what one does, what one says, what one thinks, even in the most private times and places, even when there's nobody around, do have an effect. You know, there's that story from the Dhammapala in the commentaries about the teacher who was a very wise and noble teacher, and in those days teachers were married and they had daughters and things, and of course in those days only the males used to be in the classes, because that's the way that it was in those days in their society. And all the pupils were desperate to get hold of the teacher's daughter. It's a marriage as a bride. So the teacher gave them an exercise to do. Yes, this is your exercise. I've been teaching you about morality, philosophy, ethics and statesmanship, how to run one's life well, successfully, those qualities that can lead you to be a leader in society, and a leader that is effective, and a leader that is respected and powerful. And your exercise, the prize for this exercise is the hand of my daughter in marriage, is to go out and, without anybody knowing what you've done, nobody's to know, you have to steal something, and that's your exercise. You have to steal something. Show me what you've stolen. Explain it to me, what you've stolen. And you have to work out how to do it so that nobody knows what you've done. It's an exercise in decision, precision, and getting things done properly. So, of course, different pupils came over the next month. Gave them a month to do this. Some brought very expensive things. Some brought very small things. Some explained how they'd managed to cheat, people and get something through substitute or legal ways of bending the rules. And I think there were probably about 20 or 30 people in the class, maybe less. But at the end of the month, all had come and explained to the teacher that they'd worked out how to do this. Except for one. Come on. There has to be an except for one in this. And so the class was drawn up, and the teacher said, well, I gave you your exercise. You some did this and some did that. And you've all said that nobody, you tried to explain that nobody knows that you've stolen, nobody's found out that you've stolen. Why did you not steal something? Why did you not take something? He asked the one young man who hadn't. And of course the reply was, I would have known if I'd stolen. I would have known if I'd stolen. So I couldn't steal without somebody knowing. And guess who got the bride? It's useful reflection. Why bother? Why bother? If it really doesn't matter, and if really nobody knows, if really one can have no effect on the way things are to oneself and to others, then of course why bother? But of course, if one does bother, if one does actually give careful attention to what one thinks, what one says, what one does, and one thinks, and one has the view, the paradigm, the opinion that what one thinks, what one says, and what one does have an effect, if one comes with that attention and intention and that that position, come from that position, then of course one can affect both oneself and others. Just even thinking the thought that one does, what one does think and what one says and what one does have an effect. If one just lets that thought rest in the mind a moment, how does that feel? It's a bit daunting, isn't it? It's a bit daunting, and one can take it to the sort of absurd degree and then feel that everything that happens in the whole universe is just because one has caused it. Yes, it's all my fault. Which is a sort of megalomania of another sort, isn't it? Yeah? The thought that I can't affect anything is one sort of depressive thought. The other sort of depressing thought is that it's all my fault. Everything that happens is just because of what I say, think, and feel. So it's another extreme, isn't it? Everything that happens to me or happens to other people is all my fault. Yeah? What does that feel like as a thought? Everything's my fault. I have to be extremely careful about absolutely everything because it's going to affect everything else in the whole universe. That's another another self view, isn't it? Yeah. It's another form of megalomania. And they say it's also the sometimes comes to the idea that, you know, it's all because of my karma. Everything that happens to me is because of my karma. There's that view and opinion. But causality in Buddhism is more complex than that. And that view and opinion, again, what does it do to you? As a view, as an opinion. Everything that ever happens to me is just the result of my karma. Does that feel liberating to you? Doesn't feel liberating to me. It's a view of determinant. Everything is determined. Karma is one aspect of causality. It's not the only one. It's not the only one. There, you know, the it's yes, things happen because of causes, and yes, intentional action is causative. But it's causative in a realm where there are in the totality of causality, and the totality of causality includes the way that physical things work. It includes the way that things like the weather works. It includes the way that things that gravity works. It includes the way the things that even the thought processes work. It includes the way that genetics work. It includes the way that, you know, the seeds and inheritance and that sort of things work. Those are other aspects of causality that are part of the whole picture. Yes, the way that we act by body, speech, and mind has an effect. Yes, that effect is not to be belittled and to accept responsibility for that, but it's not the whole thing. So they call it uttu-niyama is the causality of physical things, the way that the gravity works, the way that the weather functions, the way that the basic laws of what we call physics work. The niyama is the way that the seeds works, or genetic works, or the way that inheritance works, the way that things grow. Of course the two are related. Of course the two are related. The other one is the way that psychic power works, the way that thought works, the way that thinking about things works. This is useful to accept, or at least consider. You know how it is when you notice that somebody across the room is looking at you. Yes, and how they're looking at you. Women are probably better than this than others. there is an effect now. Of course, the way that intention works, the way that the kamma niyama works, is how it affects the other niyamas. It's the way that it affects the other niyamas. It's through, because so, you know, like deciding to plant something somewhere. Yeah, if you have the intention to decide to plant something somewhere. And where you plant it will affect how it grows, how much you take care of it, Yes, what you plant will affect what grows. You know, so of course, the things work together. So yes, bother. Why bother? So to take care on the karma that one does act upon. And of course, for the karma that is the important karma, as many of you know, is the karma that leads to the end of karma, that leads to the end of being bound up with things. And that's the karma of really taking care over what one says, what one thinks, and what one does. Taking the sort of care that gives it space, and sort of care that notices what's happening in the moment and allows it to be as it is, shift as it needs to shift, and not being stuck on it being particular ways according to one's opinion, but seeing what one can do, noticing what one can do. This thing of relating to things and bothering about things so that one works in ways that they actually bring benefit and blessing to one's life. And so that the bother and the care that one takes is to generate as much blessings as one can. With something like the internet, why bother? It's all on the internet. Some of you will remember when to actually have access to any sort of Dharma talks was incredibly difficult. Incredibly difficult. I can remember little cassette tapes of Dharma talks from people, and how they were valued. Ajahn Chah actually made a few little cassette tapes for people. He was quite a techie person, actually. In the days, he was one of the first Buddhist monks to actually use sort of those little cassette recorders. And in those days, one used to send cassettes to your family at Christmas time or something like that. Do you remember doing that? Yeah? Way, way, way back, before the days of cheap telephone calls. Yes, and Skype. We live in an age of information abundance. If one wishes to tap into it, and if one makes the effort to tap into it. And to use and relate to that in a way that doesn't bog you down, doesn't overwhelm, and also just doesn't waste the time, or just keep you going. You probably know, you know, that if you just type Ajahn Chah in YouTube, you can get all the videos of Ajahn Chah that there have ever been. 40 videos of a monk talking about the life of Ajahn Chah. You can get most of the Tripitaka, which you can carry around on your mobile phone probably nowadays. Essays that would fill 4 or 5 libraries, the size of the one we have here, if they printed out all the books. You can get, particularly if you understand English, if you just understand Somali or something, then it's much more difficult. But for most English speakers, the amount of information is, you drown in it if you try to swim in it, if you try to absorb, try to take it all in. And yet there's something, all of that, it, where will you really find the information that you need for liberation? Where will you find that? I'm sure it's not at the end of a mouse or just a click away. It needs to be within the instrument that you live with, you're born growing into this body and mind, working out how this one works, seeing how it is pulled and pushed by circumstances, how it's conditioned and how it's what triggers it to feel that it needs something from the situation, won't be happy without something, and see how it rejects and pushes things away. And to see how much it believes in its own self-importance. Either by thinking that it's useless and it has no need to bother about anything, or that it's completely responsible for everything. Or it just believes that it's somebody with a history. With the past. That limits it. Or a future that confines it. It's examination of that which will liberate. And it is a more visceral experience. Certainly all the information that one can find nowadays on the internet, there is the possibility of people using that in ways that do support liberation. I don't doubt that. I think it's a great idea. I do remember back in the days of cassette tapes, there was one traveling salesman. He used to go around and he used to have the company car, and he used to have cassette tapes in his car. And he always used to have Dharma tapes in his car. And he used to drive around with those, and sometimes his colleagues had to borrow his car. They were intrigued because they couldn't find any music on the cassettes. And they had to listen to all sorts of strange things happening. And for some people, it's they feel maybe it's disrespectful to listen to Dhamma whilst driving a car, or whilst doing something else in the room, cooking or hoovering or commuting or something like that. Some people think, well, if you're going to listen to Dhamma, then you should make sure you're in the right place. You put the cassette player a little bit higher and make sure you're sitting perfectly comfortably, bow 3 times, and then you can listen to the Dhamma. Well, certainly if you're going to come in here, I prefer that you weren't doing the hoovering or cooking. Because a live performance is different from a recording. it is just a recording. It's just a recording, and I feel if it reminds and keeps your mind ticking over, then it can be helpful. Just have it going. You know, there always used to be the idea that for many, many families, and they had a little cassette of Paritta chanting, and they'd always put it on as they were making the breakfast. I know that from many of my singular friends. They used to have the Parittas going as they were making the breakfast. And that's also good, you know, to have chanting or something like that going. It's not as instant access as learning things by heart. Yeah, learning things by heart is even better than having them on the internet. So, it's if they're on the internet, then the internet's down, then all the computers crashed, or the phone's not working, then you can't get access to it. So learning it by heart is best. So. And even if you can only learn a little bit by heart, then do so. At least learn a few of the basic chants by heart, in English or in Pali or both. For many of you, you know that you can do this. For many of you, you might think, I've never been able to learn anything by heart. Don't believe that thought either. It just takes obsession. If you obsess your mind with something, you will be able to learn it by heart. You can, as is proven by the fact that you've probably learned many advertising jingles by heart, and just because you've been tricked into obsessing your mind with it. But you can learn all sorts of things by heart, and it's incredibly, incredibly interesting. I mean, I can remember believing that I couldn't learn anything by heart. And I can remember learning something. And, because at school I never learned anything by heart. I thought learning something by parrot fashion was for parrots. And I thought, well, I can always look it up. Yeah, it's more intelligent to be able to look something up than to actually just fill your mind with it. That's the sort of justification for not learning things by heart. But actually, if you do learn something by heart, you do learn how your own operating system works. Your own mechanism for remembering works. Your own sense of doubt, particularly doubt. That's what you get a really good perspective on. Learning something by heart gives you insight into doubt as a hindrance and as a fetter. And this is of value because doubt is part of the first three fetters. It's all to do with how thought works. Yeah? And that's to do with personality, belief, and rites and rituals. And so learning something by heart can give you great insight into that. First of all, your personality belief that you can't learn anything by heart, which is just a thought. And then secondly, as you do learn something by heart, you learn how thinking works, how you stick something in by thinking about it. Yeah? And you might be a visual, you might be a visual person, so you might look at a piece of chanting and see how it looks, and then try to close your eyes and try to remember and sort of read it like that. Or you might be an audio person, so you might sort of say it out loud. You might be a bit of both. For different people, it's different. Different people get stuck at different places. If you learn something like the Buddha's words on loving kindness, which is a tiny bit of chant, this is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness. Yeah, Karaniya Metta in English. It's not very long, but what you do if you learn it by heart is you learn how your thinking mechanism works. You learn where it gets stuck. You learn how easy it is to link things, what silly things link things together. Yeah? And it'll be particularly impersonal to the way that your operating system works. That operating system that you believe in as being yourself. And you'll cease to believe, take it so seriously. Strange. Obsessing yourself about a chant can actually teach you how that works. I remember when Ajahn Sumedho went to a university back in 78, 79. He was in front of all these students and they said, would like you to talk and explain the Paticca Samuppada, dependent origination, yeah? He said, not sure that I can do that, but I can chant it. And something like that, even to learn the 12 links of dependent origination, is worth it, because if you turn them over and turn them over, then the way that the links work can actually start to reveal things to you. And for those people that sometimes, if they're drowsy meditating, do you ever sort of start to nod when you're meditating? You do that sometimes? One of the suggested things to do if you do that is actually to run through lists of Dhamma. Yeah? It's one of the things that one, in your mind, to actually remember, can I remember the 37 Bodhipakkhya Dhammas? 37 Bodhipakkhya Dhammas. It's not that impossible. And then just by naming something in your mind, what does it bring up? And how does it work? Huh? When you think you've known something but you've forgotten it, or you know something so well and then you come back to it and you've forgotten the part of it. It's like sometimes when you know how often we chant this Yata Varivaha Pura Paripurente, which is the opening chant for the blessing, yeah? Sometimes you can start chanting it and you think, gosh, what am I supposed to do next? And noticing how the blank spaces are is also helpful. when you know something so well that you can also forget it. Notice what brings that up. So I do recommend that a lot, because it's more useful than being able to access it on the internet. You need not even have any power to do it. Not even a charged battery. And it will work also. It'll also work if you do have things like this habitual in your mind, then they'll be close to you as the whole thing starts to break up. Because at some point, this mechanism that is best for you, for your own enlightenment, this mechanism that is best for you, for your own enlightenment, is going to break down. This one is going to break down. This body and mind is going to break down. And as it breaks down, how it is going to be really important. What sort of efforts and energies you put into it are going to be very important. Yeah? This body and mind is going to break down. And this will be an incredibly important time for you. Because what comes up then? Where does your mind, where will your mind go? Where will your attention go? Where will your heart go? What will you have been obsessing your mind with? It'll be good to know. It'll be good to know. And if you do remember the chants, some of them may come back, or maybe you'll lose your mind altogether. Maybe it'll actually just go senile on you. And it won't actually support you. But for now, you can find out how it does work by working at chance, if you wish. You can also, there's the old thing of working out how it boots up in the morning and how it shuts down at night, yeah? Paying particular attention to your boot up program and your shutdown program, yeah? It's your old one about what's your first thought when you wake up? Gosh, is that the time I need to get up? No, it doesn't need to be that. Yeah? It doesn't need to be that. No, the old one is that, the Dalai Lama, was interviewed and said that his first thought in the morning was a thought of kindness. And when I heard that, I thought, well, if he's human, I'm human, I can train my first thought. You can all do that. I asked Ajahn Sumedho what his first thought is, and he says, I go to sleep and I wake up with the sound of silence. So so you can try with that too if you want. You can decide what your first thought is in the morning. You can decide what you wake up with. It's a question of really working at it. Again, it's something you need to believe you can do, and then you need to actually put the effort in to do it. Many people have said to me that they've worked out how to do it. So you can decide what your first thought is in the morning. May I be well and happy? Or, gosh, is that the time? it's not impossible, and because you will have some sort of thought, and some sort of habit will happen, but you can actually work that. Trying to wean you off the internet, if that really is your obsession. But to use it as wisely as you can, certainly, if you do have access to it. Some of you will think, well, it's evil, keep it out. There are certainly some monastics that believe that. And, there are certainly some lay people who believe that. But for yourselves, you know, you do. It's how you relate to things, isn't it? It's how you relate to it. Do you use your relationship to the internet as something that brings you blessings, or is it something that is just a waste of time for you? I suggest that it's possible to use it as a blessing. You can fill your iPods, fill your hard drives with Dhamma talks. You can listen to Dhamma talks 24 hours a day in at least two or three languages, if you speak two or three languages. And you can have them going the whole time. You can read as much as you like. You can have all the text documents you like. You can download the Access to Insight website, the Tripitaka website in Pali, English, and Sinhala. It's absolutely stunning what you've got access to nowadays. And very fortunate and very blessed in that. We are blessed in all of this. Certainly we're blessed in all of this. And how do we continue to use this in ways that continue to generate blessings for ourselves and for others? This is really the question. And it's something that we all have to work out ourselves, for ourselves, using the instrument that we live with, this body and mind, and learning how to this works so that it can actually bring blessings. So I think that the tea's come. So we'll break for a little while, and if you'd like to have some tea, and then I'd be happy to take questions. It looks as if it's all hot there. Thank you. Anyone? Hey,